This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. James Ellroy is a popular crime novelist whose obsession with crime dates back to his childhood. His mother was murdered, strangled to death, in 1958 when he was 10. Her body was discovered on the side of the road in a suburb of Los Angeles. Ellroy's parents were divorced. He was living with his father at the time of the murder. Ellroy has written a new memoir called My Dark Places about his mother's murder and the impact it had on his life. Ellroy's crime novels include Black Dahlia, White Jazz, and American Tabloid. He still doesn't know who killed his mother, although he reopened the investigation with homicide detective Bill Stoner in 1994, the case remains unsolved. When Ellroy started investigating the murder, he found a photograph in his mother's files of her body, which he reprints in the book. I asked him to describe the photo.
My mother is lying face down in an ivy thicket on an access road adjoining a Royal High School in Almaty, California. The date is June 22, 1958. Geneva Hilliker Ellroy was 43 years old at the time of her death. Her back is mottled with postmortem lividity. There are two ligatures lashed around her neck, the stocking taken off her left leg, and a clothesline cord.
How did you get this photograph?
I first saw them in 1994 when I was 46 years old in the office of the L.A. Sheriff's Homicide Bureau. I went there to see my mother's murder file and write a piece about it for the magazine GQ.
What impact did this photograph have on you coming decades after the actual murder?
Seeing the file and seeing the photographs of my mother dead, and I saw the file first and saw the photographs of her dead last that day, made me realize, oh, this isn't over. I had always understood the extent to which my mother's death had formed me intellectually, but now I could feel it in my bones.
Now, there's another picture that's of great interest in your new book, and it's a picture of you that was taken by a press photographer one day after your mother's murder. Would you describe that photograph?
The photograph was taken of me that same day, June 22, 1958. I had come back from spending the weekend with my father in Los Angeles, came back to the house where I lived with my mother in Almaty, a crummy small town 14 miles east of downtown L.A. Pulled up in a cab, there were uniformed men, cops, and plainclothesmen in the front yard, and I sensed immediately that she was dead. Cop took me aside and said, "Son, your mother's been killed. Where's your father?" I told him he was at the bus depot waiting to go back to L.A. A few minutes later, an L.A. Times photographer led me diagonally across the yard to my landlord's tool shed. He posed me at a woodworking bench with a woodworking awl in my hand and took several pictures of me.
Were you ever doing real woodwork at that
bench?
No,
I've never done woodwork in my life.
Was there anything authentic about that picture at all?
No.
It's so interesting to see it. You look like the all-American kid.
It's my life at ground zero. And as I say in the book, I am too lost in calculation or just plain dumbfounded thought to evince signs of simple grief.
Yeah, this photograph is taken on the day when you found out your mother was murdered.
Yes.
So it's not really registering on your face. How did it register on you that day?
I was happy. I hated my mother. I lusted for my mother. My parents were divorced. My father had been systematically poisoning my mind against my mother for the 3.5, 4 years since the divorce. At the time of her death, and I was 10 years old then, my one great wish was to live with my father exclusively, and on June 22, 1958, that wish came true.
Now, you were a little kid, and you were questioned by the cops.
Yes.
How did it feel as a kid to be questioned? And what did you think of cops? Did you think of them as, you know, cops were a kid's friend, or did you think of them as, did you have any predisposition toward cops?
I liked them. They were deferential to me.
Mm-hmm.
They were respectful. They may have been somewhat dumbfounded by the fact that I wasn't showing signs of grief,
mm-hmm,
or evincing much emotion toward my mother. But they were nice. Cops questioned me, and they wanted to know about my mother's boyfriends, the men that she was seeing. And I had been predisposed by my father to think of my mother as a promiscuous drunk, and I told the cops she was a promiscuous drunk. I may have used the words, she was a drunk and a whore, which were the words that my father used to describe my mother since the divorce.
Did the cops ask you any questions that really set your imagination reeling?
They just asked about men, and it forced me to look back and recall the two times I found my mother in bed with strange men that I'd never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
It got me living again in that poisonous world that my father created around my mother and her memory.
What impact did it have on you to walk in on your mother and a boyfriend?
It was shocking. It was almost horrifying. It was 1956 and 1957 when this occurred. I was 8 and 9 years old. I was a kid at the time. I was a kid going to Lutheran church. Sex was shocking. Sex was perverted. Sex was titillating. Sex was wonderful. I knew it was something to look forward to. I knew it was the big, bad, ugly, groovy thing that people giggled about and talked about and really wanted to do all the time.
Crime writer James Elroy is my guest, and his new book is a nonfiction book about his mother's murder. It's called My Dark Places. Your mother's murder was sexually related. I wonder how that affected your sexual fantasies.
I was interested in sex early on. In My Dark Places, I describe my parents as a great-looking cheap couple along the lines of Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell in Macau. They stayed together for 15 years. It had to be sex. They were sexual people. They didn't flaunt it in front of me, but it was there. I understood it early on as subtext and went crazy with it. That my mother died in the course of a horrific, probable rape, later a sex killing, only added to the texture of my fantasies.
Did you find yourself gravitating toward women who looked like your mother?
Yes.
And did that bother you? Did you think that that was odd? Or
I felt like I was working out my own sexual dynamic. I liked older women rather than girls my own age. I seized on another murdered woman from before my birth. Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. The Black Dahlia murder case is arguably America's most famous unsolved woman killing. I first read about Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, in 1959. My father got me a book called The Badge by Jack Webb of Dragnet TV fame. And the book contained a haunting 10-page summary of the Black Dahlia murder case, and I went crazy with it. And Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, became my stand-in for Geneva Hilliker Elroy. And again, this was my means of explicating everything pertaining to my mother's death.
Mm-hmm.
And not surprisingly, many years later, I wrote a novel called The Black Dahlia.
Yeah. Now, you write in your new book that you soaked up crackpot ideas wholesale, and you even became a neo-Nazi for a while. What was the attraction of extremist propaganda to you?
There was no essential attraction. I was an extremely youthful, stupid, callow, doofus iconoclast. The junior high school and high school I went to were 97% Jewish. The only way that I stood out is that I wasn't Jewish. Thus, I became a Nazi. As I said in the book, I was the poster boy for the If You Can't Love Me, Notice Me chapter in all child psychology textbooks. My wife says the funniest line in My Dark Places is this: most of my friends were Jewish and predisposed to distrust my Nazi shenanigans.
Right. So you were willing to become somebody utterly despicable in order to get attention?
I was a buffoon. I was a clown.
Well, being a neo-Nazi is not exactly a buffoon, though. That's becoming, you know, dangerous and hateful. Whether you really take those beliefs to heart or not, just the fact that you'd be mouthing them, you know, turns you into somebody despicable.
Yes, as a 14, 15, and 16-year-old. You have to look at me then.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid, 6'3", 130 pounds, 50 pounds of it acne. My pant legs terminated several inches above my ankles. I was dangerous to myself only. I was an acquired taste that nobody ever acquired.
Do you think you ever stopped becoming dangerous to yourself only and started to become dangerous to other people too?
I was never dangerous. I was always incapable of perpetrating violence, even when I lived on the streets for years and broke into houses and sniffed women's undergarments and drank and used drugs and stole things out of stores. I was incapable of rolling drunks, and I could have done it and gotten away with it. I planned to do it one time and always faltered at the last second. I planned on doing it several times. I just couldn't do it.
You just didn't have it.
I couldn't be violent to another human being.
Why was a part of your M.O. sniffing women's undergarments?
I wanted Hancock Park, and I wanted love, and I wanted families, and I wanted sex. I had lived on the edge of this affluence for a long time, with no family, with no sex, with no money. And I had friends, buddies that lived there, and I was obsessed with the sisters of a couple of these guys. And one night, it was very late in 1966, I broke into a friend's house. And I described this in My Dark Places. I bopped around there late at night. I went in through a dog access door. I got down on my back and reached one of my long, skinny arms and popped the latch on the door inside and opened it from the inside, scooted in, walked around, checked the medicine cabinets for some dope, found some pills to take, drank bourbon out of cut glass decanters, made myself a ham sandwich, filched a $10 bill out of a wallet, went up to a girl named Heidi's bedroom and sniffed her undies. And it was a way to be in a hermetically sealed, safe, affluent, sexual, family-derived inner world. And it fueled my imagination, and I did it and did it and did it. I went back to that house repeatedly, always covered my tracks, mm-hmm. never stole things that would be noticed, was very cautious, was very circumspect, did it at a place across the street, did it at several more places in Hancock Park, did it perhaps 20, 25 times total over about 3 years.
My guest is crime writer James Elroy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is crime writer James Elroy. His new book, My Dark Places, is a memoir about his mother's murder in 1958. How did you become involved in the reopening of your mother's murder case?
I saw my mother's murder file in March of 1994. She was 36 years dead at this time. I saw it because a friend of mine, a reporter, said that he was going to see the file as part of a piece he was doing on 5 unsolved San Gabriel Valley homicides, and I realized I had to see the file and write about it for GQ. I saw my mother's murder file. It was just as shocking and revelatory an experience as you'd think it would be. The man who showed me the file was a soon-to-retire L.A. Sheriff's homicide investigator named Bill Stoner. He had nothing to do with my mother's case and, in fact, wasn't even a cop in 1958. He impressed me greatly. I saw my mother's murder file. It was like a gear clicked in my head, and it was like the little gear had a voice that said, oh, now you know. Now you can't go back.
How did the reopening of your mother's murder case change your feelings about your mother?
To begin with, I started to see that I came directly out of her. My mother, Geneva Hilliker Elroy, had a strong profligate side. She was alcoholic. She liked cheap men. Well, I had a strong profligate side. I was a housebreaking misanthrope, an alcoholic, and a drug addict, but I was able to clean up, and she never had that chance. She had a puritanical, Midwestern Protestant, hard case streak that I developed later in life. I began to see how much gender bias favored me. My mother was murdered back in 1958, and she was a woman. I was able to drink and use drugs and whore to a far greater degree than she ever probably could have or probably even imagined in the 1970s, and I was a man, and all of this was condoned by society.
You know what I found really interesting? You used to assume that your mother was raped by her murderer because there was evidence that sex had occurred right before she was murdered.
Yes.
But after reopening the investigation, you and the detective investigating the case, Bill Stoner, concluded that she had consensual sex with her killer, that they were most likely making love before she was murdered. Did you find
we've
that?
Actually gone back and forth on it.
Oh, okay.
Quite a few times.
So you're not convinced that it was
consensual? No. Stoner's most recent perspective is that it was a date rape and that occurred on the grounds at a Royal High School.
Mm-hmm.
I initially, in my GQ piece, came to the conclusion that it was consensual sex. Stoner and I have been over the two nights, June 21st, 1958, June 22nd of 58, a million times, hypothetically. We've analyzed the evidence. We have gone over it with a fine-tooth comb. And in the end, we haven't been able to make a judgment.
Mm-hmm. You still haven't found your mother's murderer. The case remains unsolved.
Right.
Do you have any theories?
Yes. I'll tell everybody out there in radio land the physical facts of the case and then extrapolate a little bit. I spent the weekend with my father in the city of Los Angeles. My mother remained in El Monte. She left the house between 8 and 8:30 Saturday night. She was seen poking her head into Mama Mia's Pizza there in the Five Point section of El Monte. Around 9 o'clock, it looked like she was looking for somebody. She was seen alone at a bar called The Manger between 9 and 9:30. She was seen in a 55 or 56 Oldsmobile at Stan's Drive-In Restaurant around 10:15 with a dark-haired, swarthy white man. She was seen an hour later with the dark-haired, swarthy white man and a blonde woman at the Desert Inn Bar, six blocks from Stan's Drive-In. At 2:30 in the morning, she was seen back at the same drive-in, waited on by the same car hop with just the swarthy man, and her body was found on the grounds at a Royal High School at 10:10 the next morning. On her second trip to Stan's Drive-In, her top was slightly unbuttoned and one of her breasts was half exposed. She was giddy. The swarthy man looked sullen. He was being uncommunicative. It was the car hop that told sheriff's detectives this. Initially, I had thought that they had made love between the visit to the Desert Inn where they were seen with the blonde woman and the second trip to Stan's Drive-In, that my mother wanted more from this man. More love, more sex, more affection, more male attention, and that the swarthy man had gotten what he wanted and wanted to ditch this desperate woman and get on with his life. The conflagration occurred because she wanted more. I felt that, I thought that when I wrote the GQ piece, and it made me love my mother fiercely because wanting more has been, in many ways, the subject of my life. More love, more recognition, more literary glory, more of the ability to write profound books, more, more, more. This is me, James Elroy, coming out of Geneva Hilliker Elroy, the murder victim, the farm girl from Tunnel City, Wisconsin. When Stoner and I began the actual hard reinvestigation of my mother's murder, Stoner took me aside and said, I have to tell you what I think happened, and I have to be very blunt. He proceeded to lay out the scenario of a last-second, horrible, ugly date rape with my mother unconscious, hit in the head, perhaps with the swarthy man's fist, perhaps with a lug wrench, and it all went down right there on the access road, which was a lover's lane beside a Royal High School. Parenthetically, Stoner has also said, you can't lock yourself into any hypothesis. You always have to remain open to new theories, and you have to remain open to the prospect that new evidence will blow out everything that you've thought before.
I wonder what it's like for you. I'm sure you're giving a lot of interviews about your new book and about your mother's murder, and it's a subject you've actually spoken about already for several years. And so, in some ways, your mother's death, the kind of centerpiece of your life in some ways, you know, the event that most shaped you, is it's a book, in a way, it's a performance, too, because it's something that you've had to talk about publicly for a long time. So, in a way, you're immersed in it and yet constantly distancing yourself from it by packaging it, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. She's with me now. I think about her continually. I discuss my mother with my wife, and my wife is easily the single most brilliant human being that I've ever met. We talk about my mother. I see my mother's face. I can smell her. I swear I can smell her from 38 years back. I think about her. I've had a lot of thrills as a writer. Nothing comes close to giving my mother to the world. I think it's ironic that she was such a private woman. She had an imperious quality to her. She had a charisma. She drew people to her. She was a handsome woman. She possessed, as I say in the book, a severe and breathtakingly implacable beauty. I want to crash the mask of that beauty. I want to know her. Thus, she's with me continually. Thus, I think it's ironic that, to an extent, I robbed her grave, I invaded her hidden time, and gave her to the world because it was the only gift of love that I could give her.
Well, James Ellroy, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Jerry, it was my pleasure.
James Ellroy's memoir about his mother's murder is called My Dark Places. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.